I'm Gail Harris. Robin Young is off today. It's Here and Now. Fighting in the Iraqi city of Najaf has died down, and the Iraqi government is reportedly negotiating with representatives of rebel leader and Shiite cleric Muqtada al-Sadr to put an end to 9 days of heavy fighting around the Imam Ali Shrine and Cemetery. Joining us on the line from Baghdad is Jackie Spinner, a correspondent for The Washington Post. And Jackie, what can you tell us about reports that Muqtada al-Sadr himself might have been injured in this fighting?
I wish I had more to tell you, but right now we still have the same conflicting reports that we've heard all day. Reports that he, from his spokespeople, that he's been injured. The Interior Ministry denied those reports today, said he had not been hurt in the gun battle. So we still don't know whether it was propaganda or something that actually had happened.
Is it a little surprising that they are, in fact, negotiating again? Because the Prime Minister, Iyad Alawi, had just said a few days ago, this is it, no more negotiations, we're done, we're going to fight to the finish.
I think it was pretty clear when Alawi went to Najaf and made that statement that he was making an attempt to show that his government was tough, that they weren't going to negotiate. But there was a widespread belief here that a good bit of that was rhetoric. I don't think either side wanted to see things escalate as they have over the past 9 days. And you often heard, you know, mixed messages from both the Iraqi government and Sadr's people saying, vowing to fight to the bitter end, and then as a caveat saying, you know, we wish to come back to the bargaining table. So I don't think that it was a surprise that this would ultimately happen. It was just a question of when it would.
Is there any sense of how long these negotiations might linger? Are there any other possibilities here, any other strategies that could be brought into play?
I think that at least from the indications we're getting to today, that both sides are going to make a valid attempt to try to resolve this. I mean, this situation doesn't help anyone. The Americans lose face by fighting in the sacred site. The Mahdi army is certainly losing face with the majority of the Shiites who don't want to see the fighting at their religious sites. And I think there's a strong push from both sides to try to get this thing resolved as soon as possible.
Well, let's talk about that a little more in terms of how the Iraqi public is responding to this, because we hear on the one hand that local residents are fed up that the Mahdi army is stashing weapons in these mosques and occupying the shrines and taking over the areas around them. And on the other hand, we also hear that people are delighted that somebody is taking on the U.S. and the National Iraqi Forces. Which is it, or is it both?
I think it's probably both. I mean, certainly in Sadr City, what we're hearing from residents there is that they're grateful that the Mahdi army is making what they would describe as a last stand against the occupation. But on the other hand, I've been out on the streets of Baghdad the last 2 days and have tried to talk to as wide a range of people as possible. And the pretty consistent message that I'm getting, at least in the middle-class neighborhoods, is people just, they're tired, they're weary, they just want it to stop.
We're also hearing from U.S. forces that they are taking extraordinary measures not to damage the holy places in Najaf. And yet we hear some concern from the Iraqi public about GIs desecrating tombs, is one of the terms. Can you balance that out for us? Any sense of which of these are correct, or again, is that a matter of perception?
Well, I think that there are Marines, and they are in the cemetery, and we've talked to them, and they have, you know, expressed some concern about stepping on the grave sites and stepping through the tombs, breaking some of the tombstones. But, you know, I think it's clear that the Mahdi army and the militia down there drew the Marines into that battle knowing what the public response would be. And the public response to GIs in that cemetery is negative. And that's probably contributed to some of the spillover violence that you've seen elsewhere in Iraq.
Jackie, thank you so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Jackie Spinner is a correspondent for The Washington Post. She joined us on the line from Baghdad. Polls out today on the presidential race give a sense of how close the contest is between George Bush and John Kerry. A Gallup poll gives the president a 3-point lead nationally, while the latest Rasmussen report gives Kerry a 3-point lead. Polling in battleground states such as Ohio, Michigan, and Florida shows Kerry edging ahead of the president. The Bush campaign is responding with a new TV ad today.
In 1972, there were 40 democracies in the world. Today, 120. Freedom is spreading throughout the world like a sunrise. And this Olympics, there will be two more free nations and two fewer terrorist regimes.
Well, joining us on the line is John Harwood, national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. Hi, John.
Great to be here.
This latest ad refers to the Olympics in terms of its timing, but, you know, thematically in listening to it, it sounds as if this is the kind of thing that you would hear more in the waning days of October than in August.
Well, George W. Bush has got to look for ways to make tangible what happened in Iraq for the American people. The American people are beginning to question whether this war was worth it. And this is a way for the president to frame it in terms of the broader march of democracy and try to reinforce his advantages as a leader in the war against terrorism and the war against tyranny.
Well, I want to get your thoughts on some of the more incendiary statements from the past week on the campaign trail. We heard from Vice President Cheney slamming Kerry for his comment last week that he would wage a more sensitive war in Iraq. Now, the Kerry campaign says that what Kerry was mentioning here was being sensitive to the concerns of allies, not being sensitive to terrorists. And, in fact, General Wesley Clark called it a cheap shot. Is Cheney in attack mode again because there's some concern in the Bush camp about erosion in the polls that Kerry may be breaking out a little here?
Well, sure. And yes, it is a cheap shot. But of course, a lot of what happens in political campaigns on both sides is cheap shots. Dick Cheney was looking for a way to try to dramatize the difference, the sort of bright line it's trying to draw between the Bush-Cheney policy and what they argue the Kerry policy would be. And they're trying to paint John Kerry, John Edwards, as a little bit vacillating, a little bit wimpy, so to speak, even though John Kerry is a decorated veteran of Vietnam. And they found a word that happens to suit that purpose, and they jumped on it.
And then there was also the quote from John Kerry, perhaps inadvertently giving the Bush administration some ammunition here, when he responded to a challenge from President Bush, yes or no, would Kerry have voted the same way on the Iraq war resolution if he had known then what he knows now?
Yes, I would have voted for the authority. I believe it was the right authority for a president to have. But I would have used that authority, as I have said throughout this campaign, effectively.
So, John Harwood, a little too nuanced for the campaign trail?
Well, this is the challenge that John Kerry faces. He does have a nuanced position, but he's got a balancing act between all of these Democrats who feel very intensely that the war was a mistake, that it never should have been fought in the first place, and trying to show himself as a mainstream leader on defense and security issues. And he's reaffirming it, even though it's inflamed tremendous opposition to him. John Kerry has got a little bit more complicated argument to make.
One more ad I'd like to play for you. That is another from the Bush campaign. It was released this week. It's called Solemn Duty.
My most solemn duty is to lead our nation to protect ourselves. I can't imagine the great agony of a mom or a dad having to make the decision about which child to pick up first on September the 11th. We cannot hesitate. We cannot yield. We must do everything in our power to bring an enemy to justice before they hurt us again.
Well, there again, John Harwood, very much on message. I'm not sure if I get the part about which child you're going to pick up.
That's funny, Gail, because I didn't get that either. I did think, though, in terms of stagecraft, this was an effective ad for the president. Notice the use of Laura Bush. She is very effective. She's a sympathetic figure. She doesn't make people upset. And the Bush campaign is counting on her to help soften his image a bit.
John Harwood is national political editor for The Wall Street Journal. Well, banks in Portland, Oregon might want to take note. President Bush and Senator Kerry will both be campaigning there today. And the last time both candidates descended on one town in Davenport, Iowa last week, three banks were robbed. So should banks in Portland be worried?
No, not necessarily. Banks in Portland will have the same secure features that they always have in place, sophisticated alarm systems, bait money, and surveillance cameras to help law enforcement catch these robbers. You'll note that the robbers from Davenport are in jail now, and that's certainly one good deterrent against it.
That word from John Hall, spokesman for the American Bankers Association. Well, for a sense of the campaigns, we thought we'd check in with two reporters who've been out on the trail with the candidates. Jeff Zeleny, correspondent for the Chicago Tribune, has been covering the Bush campaign. Hi, Jeff.
Hello.
And Jody Wilgren, correspondent for the New York Times, who's on the trail with John Kerry. Hello, Jody.
Hi, good to be with you.
I want to ask each of you, Jeff, maybe you first, how long have you been out on the campaign trail, and how exhausting is it, both for you and for the candidates?
Well, this is the second week that I've been out with the president this month. You know, it's a pretty grueling schedule, probably more so for his supporters and his staff and us than for him. We started the week in Florida doing a bus tour, driving around the three cities in the Panhandle. And the thing I sort of am amazed by are all these thousands of supporters who wait hours and hours and hours just for one brief shot at him. So I think those folks are the ones who are exhausted.
And Jody, how about you?
It has been a pretty exhausting trip for John Kerry since he left the convention in Boston. I realized how exhausted John Kerry is yesterday when we were in California and he was making a comparison to Harry Truman's cross-country trip, quoted Harry Truman, and in trying to kind of mimic the quote, referred to himself, John Kerry, as 61 years old when he's in fact only 60. So I think if you're messing up your own age, maybe it's because you're pretty tired.
I would imagine. Let's hope they can keep their name straight. You know, when we watch these events on television, they almost seem indistinguishable. A lot of people seeming enthusiastic, waving flags. What does it feel like when you're actually there? We hear that Kerry is attracting big crowds these days.
Yeah. Last night, he had something like 10,000 people in a very, very hot county fairgrounds outdoor arena. One thing that's pretty funny I've noticed this week particularly is Kerry just never misses a chance to, like, pander to the locals with a cheesy line. Last night we got there and he said, I'm going to take some tough positions today, but I'm not fool enough to choose between the Black Tornadoes and the Panthers, which, of course, is two local high school teams or something. And he does the same thing everywhere he goes. I don't know who feeds him these lines, but it's almost like a little Borscht Belt routine.
Jody Wilgren is covering the Kerry campaign for the New York Times, and Jeff Zeleny is covering the Bush campaign for the Chicago Tribune. He joined us from the press plane, taking off for Portland, Oregon. Just ahead, America loses its French chef, cooking icon Julia Child. And later in the program, an economic crisis in the Dominican Republic is forcing many people to take to dangerous high seas. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Gail Harris. It's Here and Now. Well, you never know what'll turn up from the cutting room floor these days. This week, President Bush nominated Congressman Porter Goss to direct the Central Intelligence Agency. Back in March, Goss was interviewed by Michael Moore's production company for the film Fahrenheit 9/11. Part of the interview wound up in the film, part of it didn't. And now the bit that didn't make it is running on michaelmoore.com. In that excerpt, Goss says he's not qualified to head up the CIA.
I couldn't get a job with CIA today. I am not qualified. I don't have the language skills. My language skills were romance languages and stuff. We're looking for Arabists today. I don't have the cultural background, probably, and I certainly don't have the technical skills, as my children remind me every day, Dad, you got to get better on your computer. So the things that you need to have, I don't have.
Today, the White House called news of the Goss interview ridiculous hearsay. Julia Child, America's favorite French chef, died in her California home yesterday, a few days short of her 92nd birthday. Through her books and television programs, she introduced millions of Americans to French food. 4 years ago, Here and Now's Robin Young interviewed Child at her Cambridge, Massachusetts home, in the kitchen designed by her late husband. Child had just been awarded the Legion of Honor by the French government.
Hi. How are you?
Good.
We brought you some flowers.
Hold on, I've got to go.
Nice. Okay. I'll just take my jacket off.
Please do.
Yeah.
Make yourself at home.
This kitchen has never changed over the years. We first spoke in the 70s.
Yes, we did.
And it's the same. Paul designed this.
Well, Paul designed this. When, you know, when we bought this house in 1956, we just really entered the front door and we knew that this was it. And it had this great big kitchen and we've got two pantries, which is amazing.
Mm.
And then Paul decided that on the color scheme, which is black and green and blue, and stainless steel and wood.
Yep.
And he said, "Well, you put everything out. I like things hung up." He said, "You put it out and I'll arrange it." So we put out all these beautiful copper pans, and then he arranged this beautiful arrangement here.
There's like
20
of them.
And then we have the knives, you know, hung up on very, very strong magnets.
Right. So they're right there in front of you.
Lying horizontally.
There's about 50 knives.
Well, probably. I'm a kind of a knife freak.
Okay.
And then I have an awful lot of frying pans. But I like having everything hung up.
Yeah. Well, you're so busy here in your kitchen as usual, but we just want to take a second to congratulate you on your Legion of Honor.
That's wonderful, isn't it? I'm thrilled about that.
Really, what does it mean to you?
Well, it means a lot because I really love and admire France, and we had such a wonderful time there, and I'm honored to be so honored by them or recognized.
You know, this is an award created by Napoleon, and then we were thinking, and you make Napoleons, so.
Yes.
What is it about French cooking and the French?
Well, you just have to eat it and taste it, and it's so delicious. It's really the best French cooking is very, what they would call cuisine soignée, very careful cooking of. The green beans are exactly right, and everything. I think people who don't know French cooking think that it's awfully fancy and all that cream and butter and fancy sauces, but it's just plain good cooking. It's just delicious because they really care about it.
You changed the way Americans cooked and the way they viewed food.
Well, I think people, they thought that French food was a mystery. For one thing, it was in a foreign language, and then they didn't realize that it was perfectly available to anybody if you just knew how you were doing it.
Yeah.
And it's not that difficult.
If you had to say three tips to a cook just sort of making their way, three tips.
Well, one, read the recipe through before you begin. And then I think go right on through with it. Don't stop and go and play tennis halfway through making a cake or something like that. Because the eggs will deflate.
You want
and have fun and have courage. And some people, they'll look and they're so afraid. Oh, it's just 3 tablespoons of tomato paste and I only have 2. What am I going to do? You know, that kind of thing. And that's all what we tried to show in our show with Jacques Pépin of there about 40 different ways of doing something. So if it doesn't work one way, it'll work another. It's not written in stone. And use your imagination and have a bit of a devil-may-care attitude.
Relax.
Relax and have fun.
How do you feel you have really been our companion for years in the kitchen. I mean,
I have, gosh, it's for 40 years, I think.
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's nice. And I think we're very lucky to have been on public television because you can do what you want. I mean, if I'd been on commercials, would I ever have been able to do tripe and kidneys and things like that?
I don't think so.
No.
I don't think so.
No. No.
Didn't you burn a potholder once?
Well, I burned a lot of things. One of the nicest ones, we were on a commercial television morning show, and they had a whole lot of confetti or something hanging down in front of the set. And I was doing flaming something or others. And whenever I do, I put loads of bourbon or whatever it was in the pan. And enormous flames. and they caught some of this confetti, and I, right in there, it was alive, so I just took it and threw it down in front of the camera, and we went on. Things like that are fun, aren't they?
Oh, yes.
Because they couldn't stop because it was live.
The award, it's just wonderful. I mean, so many people have received it. We can't think of any downside to receiving the Legion of Honor, except perhaps.
What?
Are you aware that Jerry Lewis has received this honor as well from
the
French?
Oh, that's nice. Well, they love they love him. I know that.
So do I.
That's wonderful.
Well, thank you so much. It's always such a pleasure to visit with you.
It's been fun to see you again.
And congratulations. We'll have to salute you next time we see you.
Yes, you will. That's wonderful.
Take care.
Thank you.
Robin Young speaking in 2000 with Julia Child, who died yesterday at the age of 91. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Gail Harris. It's Here and Now. On Sunday, Venezuelans will be voting on whether to recall their controversial president, Hugo Chavez. So far, polls seem evenly split between his supporters and opponents, but some pollsters say the outcome could hinge on a hidden vote, people who won't say out loud which way they're leaning. Well, joining us on the line from Caracas is Miami Herald reporter Stephen Dudley. And Stephen, I want to ask you about the mood heading up to this weekend. Secretary of State Colin Powell issued a statement on Wednesday urging Venezuelans to maintain peace there, which leads to the question of why he's so worried about violence.
Well, he's worried because in the past there has been violent clashes between both the opposition forces and Chavez supporters. Down here, I can tell you the mood is seemingly a little less tense than it has been. And even though you would think this would be the vote that the opposition forces, anyway, have been waiting for many years, the thing about it is that the opposition forces seem to have lost a lot of momentum in the last few weeks. And by all appearances, Chavez seems to be heading for another victory.
Well, there was already one attempt to overthrow him a couple of years ago. I wonder if you'd refresh our memories as to that event and also tell us why is he so controversial?
Well, in April 2002, a group of high-level military officers working in concert with a number of civilian groups, including some media outlets here, actually overthrew Chavez's government. This particular overthrow was actually reversed by members of the military who were still loyal to Chavez. Chavez remains a controversial character for many reasons, largely because of his rhetoric. He's very anti-U.S. in his rhetoric and, in theory, has reached out to other places in the region to form some sort of bloc to, contrast the power of the U.S. with the power of what Latin Americans could be. And the most damaging part of these alliances is his connections to Cuba.
And so some people then see him as a champion of the poor, and others see him as possibly a communist dictator of some sort.
Certainly, he's probably closer to somewhere in the middle. And the most interesting thing being that his rhetoric doesn't necessarily match his actions. He will talk very badly about the imperialists in the United States on one day, and the very next day he'll go off and sign an oil agreement with some of the largest oil companies in the world.
If he does win decisively this weekend, might that mean calmer days ahead for Venezuela?
Well, only in the sense that he will have again legitimized his power. He will have once again shown that he's going to be a very hard person to topple by means other than electoral processes.
And, Stephen, you've been writing in recent days about some of the problems dogging the polling world there. What is keeping some pollsters from doing their jobs as effectively as they might like, and why are polls so important in this election?
Well, polls, as we know in the United States, can be used by all sides involved in an election. If you have this sort of idea that you are in the lead, in particular in places in Latin America, that tends to sort of, you know, bolster your supporters. It's been very difficult for people who want to get accurate results in polls to get them because people are very afraid. There was a lot of repercussions for people who signed the petition so that there would be a referendum this Sunday. Many of them lost their jobs. Others were having trouble getting passports and securing other government services that they would normally get without problems.
Stephen, thank you.
Thank you.
Stephen Dudley reports for the Miami Herald from Venezuela. This week, about 50 refugees from the Dominican Republic died at sea after they set sail for Puerto Rico. Thousands of people have risked their lives since last October to escape the worsening economic situation in the Dominican Republic. Throughout the 1990s, the nation of 8 million people, which shares an island with Haiti, was considered an economic success story. And joining us to talk about the reversal of fortune in the Dominican Republic is Dan Erickson, Director of Caribbean Programs for the Inter-American Dialogue, a think tank based in Washington, D.C. Dan, thanks for being with us.
Thank you very much.
You know, many of us find this a little puzzling. The Dominican Republic was always the beautiful and prosperous part of the island. Haiti was the poor part. What happened?
There's a couple of factors involved. One was just some structural inefficiencies in the economy that weren't being taken care of by President Mejia during his term. But what really set this off was a massive banking scandal which occurred in the spring of 2003, in which approximately 15% to 20% of the country's annual gross domestic product was apparently siphoned off by several corrupt people working for this particular bank, Banintur. And that really provoked a crisis of confidence from which the economy has yet to recover.
And so this was a ripple effect then of fuel prices going up, the peso being devalued?
Right. There's a number of different things that happened. You had the devaluation of the peso. You also have this ongoing energy crisis and energy crunch driven partially by the high prices for oil on the world market, but also because the assets that the Dominican Republic has weren't being managed particularly well. And then, of course, you had a dip in foreign direct investment because while the Dominican Republic had been the darling of foreign investors for several years, there was really a perception that became widespread that, in fact, the Dominican Republic is not a good place to do business right now.
There are about 1 million Dominicans who live in the U.S. Many of them send money home. How is this crisis affecting them, and how are they responding to the economic crisis back home?
Well, I think what you're seeing is this really puts an extra strain on Dominicans living in the United States. Remittances, which are family transfers from Dominicans in the United States to Dominicans in the Dominican Republic, are about $1 billion a year. And so you do have this continued flow of money going back to the country, which helps to keep the economy on life support.
And there's also a newly elected president now, Leonel Fernandez, who ran on a platform of fixing the economy. And one would presume that he knows how to do it because when he was president before, the economy did do well. So what does he need to do now?
Well, there's a number of different things he needs to do. One is certainly try to get the country's budget under control. Right now, it's running a pretty large deficit. The second thing is to try to strike a new deal with the international financial institutions.
Well, in the meantime, there are, of course, these dozens and more Dominicans who aren't being allowed to stay here. They're being sent back home. Your thoughts on that?
We do know that there are certain passages that are very commonly taken, such as between the Dominican Republic and Puerto Rico, that are also extremely dangerous. I think one response of U.S. policy could certainly be to deploy more Coast Guard cutters in that area, not for the purpose of punishing Dominicans, but for the purpose of making sure that you don't have people suffering the tremendous tragedy which happened this week.
Dan, thank you.
Great. Thank you very much.
Dan Erickson is Director of Caribbean Programs for the Inter-American Dialogue, a think tank based in Washington, D.C. And this note, the Associated Press has just issued a correction saying that Julia Child died early today, not yesterday, as we reported a few moments ago. You're listening to Here and Now. New Jersey's Democratic Governor James McGreevy says he did not announce his resignation yesterday because he is gay, but because his extramarital affair with a man could compromise his ability to govern. Sources around the New Jersey Statehouse say that McGreevy and his inner circle have been hounded in recent weeks by what they're describing as extortionate demands by the governor's former lover, who was reportedly threatening a sexual harassment suit against McGreevy unless he was paid up to $5 million. Well, Herb Jackson is a political columnist for the Bergen Record. He joins us from Trenton, New Jersey. And Herb, you have to wonder, is there more to this story than what's been reported so far?
Oh, well, there's certainly more than the governor said during his brief statement yesterday. There still is rumored to be a lawsuit filed by the governor's former lover, who the governor brought in 2002 as his advisor on Homeland Security. He had to take him out of that post after it was found that as an Israeli national, he couldn't get national security clearance. And that raised some questions about why he put the man in the position to begin with. And I think that that was what really drove him to leave, was not necessarily his sexual orientation, although there is a lot of questions about a man who admits he's gay but marries two women and fathers children with both of them. But the question that he put the person he was having any affair with on the state payroll, making six figures, that would have been, to me, the critical blow to the governor's reelection chances. What we've seen in New Jersey is when their scandal gets too hot, if the focus of the scandal gets out, the Democratic Party seems to survive. In 2002, we had Senator Torricelli drop out, and in just a few weeks, the party replaced him with former Senator Lautenberg and kept the Senate seat. And what happens is the Republicans are building up all this ammunition toward the scandal guy. Suddenly he's out of the picture, and what do they have left to fire with?
And McGreevy, while he's been a very popular governor, he's certainly no stranger to scandal either. What are some of the other problems that his administration has been facing for the last couple of years?
Well, he's a complex guy. When he comes into a room, he'll shake hands and he'll remember people's names. And he put a lot of his political capital behind things like reforming the agency that's supposed to deal with troubled children and for cancer research and for better reading coaches for kids in second grade. But he also had a lot of guys around him who were somewhat seedy. His chief of staff and chief counsel had to quit at the end of the first year of his term after widening disclosures about millions of dollars they had made in the weeks leading up to them joining the administration in a billboard business. His top contributor, a real estate developer, was named in an indictment. These were a series of landmines that we saw in the future for the governor, that any one of them could blow up and knock him out of the race.
Well, and now McGreevy's saying that he's going to stay in office until November 15th, which means there won't be an emergency election to replace him. How are people reacting to that?
I know that the Republicans are, some of them are saying, we want an election right away. Other Republicans say, well, if we have the election right away, then they might bring in John Corzine as their white knight. He's a U.S. senator. And the Republicans could get blown out of that race. But then there are some Democrats who would rather not have the Senate president, who would fill in a McGreevy vacancy and serve as both Senate president and acting governor for the year of 2005. He is not popular with a lot of the party bosses because he's a veteran in the legislature. He goes his own way. He doesn't need bosses to tell him what to do. And they're still pressuring McGreevy to get out before the end of this month, which would force a special election.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Herb Jackson is a political columnist for the Bergen Record. Stay with us. There's more ahead, here and now. I'm Gail Harris. It's Here and Now. The 2004 Olympic Games officially opened today. On Wednesday, you may remember, we looked at some of the American athletes to watch, and today we thought we'd survey the rest of the world. Joining us once again is Los Angeles Times sports reporter Helene Elliott. Helene, welcome.
Thank you.
Let me ask you first about this big news today about the Greek sprinter Konstantinos Kenderis. He's the defending Olympic champion in the 200 meters. Didn't show up, apparently, for his scheduled drug tests, and then he and his training partner were involved in a motorcycling accident. What's that all about?
The plot thickens. Now is the time for that dramatic music, organ music that you would, you know, hear like in a soap opera. There have been many rumors about him and about the other sprinter, Katerina Thanou, that perhaps they've had a habit of missing drug tests and not being where they were supposed to be when they were supposed to have drug tests.
Well, and he's a national hero in Greece. His picture's all over billboards everywhere. The Greeks must be devastated, especially because this apparently means he's not going to be able to light the cauldron.
Yeah, it's everybody's kind of in a tizzy here. It's all over the news, and it's almost like how we in the U.S., how all the networks and everybody flocked to the O.J. Simpson trial with mini cams and all that, and we've seen TV pictures of a very similar scene outside the offices where the two sprinters were supposed to have their hearing today. So it's the tabloid mentality translates internationally.
Stay tuned, as they say. Well, let's look at some of the other sports. So we've been hearing a lot, of course, about the American swimmer Michael Phelps and his quest for maybe 8 gold medals. But the Australians would probably say, well, not so fast. We have Ian Thorpe, the torpedo. How good is he?
Ian Thorpe is pretty good. There's going to be some tremendous races in the swimming. It's just going to be drama after drama after drama. The U.S. and Australia should dominate the medals, but there are a number of other events that European countries will win.
And also in men's basketball, not exactly a slam dunk for the Americans there.
Yeah, it's really interesting how they started out and whether that exhibition loss against Italy will be a wake-up call, as Allen Iverson had said it would be.
Which of the other teams should we be looking out for?
Serbia and Montenegro always has a very strong, very physical team. Italy, you know, if the U.S. gets to play Italy again, what would happen then? Spain, I mean, there's a lot of international teams that are very strong, and these are teams that, you know, used to watch the NBA on TV, and now they've developed their own programs, and they're at a very high level internationally.
Women's gymnastics. We have a Russian gymnast, Svetlana Korkina, who's making her third Olympic appearance. I just love it that she's 25 years old, you know, and not 15 and 82 pounds.
Let's hear it for those old ladies. Yay. Ancient. And there's also a woman, Oksana Chusovitina, who competes for Uzbekistan, and she may very well win the vault gold medal, and she's up there in her late 20s and actually is the mother of a son. You know, in the women's gymnastics, you have to watch Diane dos Santos of Brazil. She's the most amazingly powerful tumbler. I mean, watch her on floor exercise, and you'll just be entranced. She is just terrific.
Just final thoughts. Anybody else we should be paying particular attention to in the coming weeks?
Well, one of the beauties of the Olympics is the surprises. You know, people who come out of nowhere and have the performances of their lives on a given day. And that's what I love about this. You know, it's easy to say Michael Phelps was going to win medals, and he probably will. But, you know, I want to know about the Kenyan distance runner or some of these other folks who, you know, toil in sports like maybe fencing or shooting or rowing, who are maybe even purer athletes, if there is such a thing, because they also have to have jobs and can't train full-time, and they don't have million-dollar endorsements. And I love to write about and talk to people like that.
Certainly no lack of great stories there.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Helene.
Thank you.
Helene Elliott, sports reporter for the Los Angeles Times, spoke with us from Athens, where a Trojan horse and figures from mythology are part of today's opening ceremonies, a salute to the ancient home of the Olympic Games. Joining us on the line to tell us more about what the original Olympic Games have to teach us today is Stephen Miller, a professor of archaeology at the University of California in Berkeley and author of the new book, Ancient Greek Athletics. He joins us on the line from Greece. Hello, Stephen.
Thank you.
Throughout its history, the Olympics have been marred by protests and boycotts and terrorist attacks. But take us back to ancient times first. What was the political climate like during the very first Olympic Games?
Well, there have always been politics involved, and the Olympics have always provided a venue for making a statement. There were at various times attempts by political leaders to use the games to promote themselves and their own city-states. There are cases of ancient athletes who were hired away from their own native land to compete for other city-states. For example, a fellow named Astylos in 488 B.C. competed for his native Croton and won an Olympic victory. The following Olympiad, 4 years later, he was hired away by Syracuse. He won again, but his former fellow citizens in Croton pulled his statue down and turned his house into a jail, which apparently was some sort of big insult. But the premise behind his being hired was clearly for political advantage.
Were the original athletes more focused on glory or on the prizes they would win?
Certainly, glory played a major role in it, but there were prizes. And when you went home with your crown of olive from Olympia or laurel from Delphi, you had a ticker tape parade. The real form it took in antiquity was the city wall was knocked down so that you could ride through in your chariot. And you got a free meal every day for the rest of your life at state expense. Another aspect of the ancient games I'd like to emphasize, the competitions were events that could be determined by objective criteria. Who crossed the finish line first? Who threw the discus the furthest? There were no events that required panels of judges to award points or anything of that sort. And I believe that's the primary reason for the longevity of the Olympic Games.
Notwithstanding that, some people say that the ancient games lost their purity and their high idealism over time, that they became a business. Do you agree?
Yes, that's clear in the sources. There's no question of that. And the real distinction is not the advent of money, because money was always a part of the game. The real distinction I think we have to make is that by the time of Alexander the Great, athletes become a means of supporting yourself, depending upon that for your livelihood. It's a part, again, of the entertainment industry. Athletics really became an entertainment industry.
You have been excavating ruins in Greece since 1973, and I wonder what are some of the key things that you've found that really help us understand that time period and those people better?
Particularly in an athletic context, it's the stadium with the entrance tunnel that led into the stadium from a locker room and the discovery of the locker room itself. But this tunnel is 130 feet long. It's in an excellent state of preservation. And this makes two major statements to us about athletics. One, it is providing a separate entrance for the athlete so that when the athlete's name is called and he runs out onto the track, he sort of erupts out onto the playing field. And there's a theatrical quality that is a harbinger of the entertainment industry that ancient athletics were to become. The second thing that is the most humanizing aspect of all are the dozens of graffiti scratched on the walls, names of people. In some cases, we can identify them as known athletes. In other cases, we don't know who they were. Presumably, all of them were athletes. The urge to gain some sort of immortality by defacing public property with your name goes right back to 2,300 years from ago.
I have to ask, because you are there in Greece, and this has been your field of study for so long, what is it like for you being there? Do you think it really is about time that the Games came home?
It's exciting. I have been a fan of the Olympic Games all of my life. This is the first time that I'll ever get to see them, because I've always been in the trenches digging at the time of the Games. And I'm looking forward to actually being able to go to a couple of the Games.
Well, I'm sure most people would say that enjoy. You've certainly earned it.
Oh, thank you.
Stephen Miller is professor of classical archaeology at the University of California in Berkeley and author of the new book, Ancient Greek Athletics. Here and Now is a production of WBUR Boston. I'm Gail Harris. Get into your radio and join us again, Here and Now. For a cassette or CD of Here and Now, go to our website, here-now.org, or call 1-800-909-9287. Cassettes or CDs are $15 each, which includes shipping and handling.
Funding for Here and Now comes from the MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink technical computing software, on the web at mathworks.com.